On June 5, 2004, Dr. Vandana Shiva spoke at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Geary Street in San Francisco as part of a Reclaim the Commons teach-in. Here, Luke Anderson, author of Genetic Engineering, Food, and Our Environment, introduces her.
Dr. Vandana Shiva is a physicist, an ecologist, and a world-renowned author on biotechnology, traditional agriculture, and the politics of globalization. She is the founder of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in New Delhi, India, and the Navdanya Project and Seed Farm in her native Dehradun. She is the recipient of the 1993 Right Livelihood Award, and her most recent books are Water Wars and Stolen Harvest, both published by Southend Press. Dr. Vandana Shiva.
This trip of mine is really Operation Food Freedom. And it's not doublespeak. And the reason it's become so important that we offer a little solidarity to you from across the world is because the country that is eating the largest amount of genetically modified food is the country that knows least about that fact. And to me, an indicator of freedom is whether or not you can choose what you eat and know what you eat. And if those two factors are missing, we aren't really living in free societies. Must have been about 17 years ago, 1987, I was at a meeting near Geneva where the biotech industry was laying out its plans. That's the time I came to know about a trade treaty that was being negotiated called the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs with Agriculture and Intellectual Property Rights. That's the time I came to know that the reason they needed to deploy genetic engineering was because only by doing that could they do agriculture, produce medicine in ways that ordinary human beings don't. It was their comparative and competitive advantage. But most importantly, they needed new monopoly rights, new intellectual property to make it all happen. And they had laid out their blueprint. But just listening to what that plan was, for me, became a very, very clear image of our future being a future of slavery and the planet being a prison for all of us, where no one could choose what they grew, no one could choose how they farm. We would be condemned to dependency on the five corporations which engage in biotechnology, especially in agriculture. And I love freedom too much to accept that. So by the time I got home, I started to save seeds. I wasn't trained to do it. I was trained to do good quantum theory. But fortunately, there are enough people from whom you can learn. There are enough peasants in the world. And today, Navdanya is providing real alternatives, not just for agriculture in India, but I believe through the fact that we started to practice the reality that had to be shaped. A number of things happened along with it. The first was, just by doing organic farming and using biodiversity, it became extremely clear that we can grow much more food at much lower cost than all the industrial agriculture and all the genetic engineering. So the practice of organic farming and biodiverse farming became an absolute explosion of the myth that we needed chemicals for farming, and without genetic engineering, the world would starve. In any case, 1984, I had been troubled very much by a number of events that took place in our country. That was the year where in summer, June 4th, 1984, 20 years ago, our farmers of Punjab had announced they would blockade the supply of grain because they said they were farming under slave conditions. Now, these were the farmers who were supposed to have benefited from the Green Revolution, the industrial farming. And yet, they were not experiencing this as freedom. They were experiencing it as slavery, because with it went indebtedness, With it went no choice about what you'll grow. You had to grow the rice in one season and the wheat in the other season. Those were the only two crops that the Green Revolution offered. The prices at which things would sell were also fixed by a centralized system. When the water would be released from the dam would be decided in Delhi and not in Punjab. And you might not remember, but the 80s was a period of very serious terrorism in the state of Punjab. The Golden Temple was attacked. Eventually, Indira Gandhi, our prime minister of that time, was assassinated. And something was wrong with the story of the Green Revolution that every textbook and every propaganda tells you. Because even now, biotechnology is offered as the second Green Revolution. It's always offered as solving through technology the problem of food entitlements. The Green Revolution was given a Nobel Prize for Peace, but it left war in Punjab, a war that killed 30,000 people. That's six times more than the people we lost in the 9/11 attacks. If the Green Revolution was about prosperity and peace, but the farmers were experiencing deprivation and we had war, something was wrong with the story. And so I started to study it. And at the end of it, came to a few very simple conclusions. One, that the Green Revolution was never about feeding people. It was really about finding a new deployment of weapons of mass destruction that had no use after the wars. Pesticides that were used to kill people were now used to kill insects. But of course, they would also kill people, as in the big leak of the Union Carbide Bhopal gas disaster. 3,000 people dead in one night, 30,000 people dead since then. And there are millions who die daily in farms. This combination of violence, of the tools themselves being tools of warfare, is part of the reason I started to look closely at agriculture. But to develop alternatives in practical ways, not just in scientific and intellectual ways, became really an imperative just to breathe free, eat free, stay free. And one of my favorite poems and very inspiring poems is a very, very lovely Palestinian poem. I've used it in my book, Biopiracy. It basically talks, you can destroy our villages, you can bomb our homes, you can tear down our farms, you can destroy everything till no bird, no word, no insect can find a place to hide. You can do that and more. But I do not fear your tyranny. I do not lose hope because I have one little seed which I will save and plant again. And I believe that seed is both metaphorical as well as symbolic. It's symbolic in the time where freedom is being taken away through colonization of life. But it is also the real seeds that we have to save. The real seeds of knowledge, the real seeds that grow plants out, the real seeds of organizing, the real seeds of thinking beyond the cages. Because long before we are imprisoned in bars, we are imprisoned in the mind. And those who have imprisoned minds are the ones who cannot tolerate free minds, free people, free species. What we are seeing, whether it's Iraq or the prisons or genetic engineering imposed on the world, it's coming from the same minds and the same people. Just look at the list of people who have huge Monsanto interests. They're also the same people that are behind Operation Iraqi Freedom. They're not different. Some of them have heavier interest in oil, and some of them have heavier interest in biotech. But between the two industries, they cover basically everything. And for those who have such a huge stake in imprisoning and enslaving life for their personal returns, obviously every seed that grows free, every community that farms free, every society that eats free is a major threat. That's why I want to say three cheers to all of you who have not disappeared in spite of the Patriot Act and in spite of Homeland Security, that you're still there. I, I think a year ago when the food summit was taking place on how do you solve the problem of a billion people going hungry on a regular basis, something humanity has never suffered before. Hunger throughout human history has been localized in space and time. In some places, some people stayed free for a short while because of a drought, because of a flood, because of a war. But that permanently a billion people would be denied food is an achievement of a world based on capital-intensive farming, control of agribusiness over agriculture, and systems of food production and food distribution designed not for human welfare, but for corporate welfare. That's why we have hunger today. We have hunger because farmers who have to buy the seeds and the chemicals can't afford to keep the food they've grown. They have to sell it immediately just to pay back the debt. And what they sell at a quarter pie price, they buy at four times that price to eat as food. Most people who are hungry today are rural people who are producing food. Earlier, hunger was an urban phenomenon. Now it has become a problem faced by producers of food, which should tell us something is wrong with the way we are producing food. Now, if some of you had the possibility to get news about the recent Indian elections by those who actually live in the country and did not have to depend on the Thomas Friedmans of the world, one very, very touching phenomena that happened in our elections in the last month was first that the last government was very much a sort of a Bush twin, you know. They got along very well together. And the last government even hired an American ad company to work out the election campaign. In India, people still go house to house, door to door to ask for votes. But our government thought, you know, we got to be high tech. That was the most frequently used word. We got to be high tech. So they wanted to do it like your elections are through the media. And of course, for the media, you need a spin. And the spin that was given by an American ad agency for a country like India was, say India is shining, India shining, and tell people there's a feel-good factor. So Mr. Advani and Mr. Vajpayee and Pramod Mahajan, everyone trotted off to say, shining India and the feel-good factor. Except that neither of these phrases translate into any Indian language. But more importantly, the rural communities were not feeling very good under the pressure of globalization. They were not feeling very good as Monsanto had entered the Indian seed supply and bought up every major Indian seed company. The result of which was that the seeds had become more costly and chemicals were obviously needed to go with these hybrid seeds and the new genetically engineered seeds. Farm debts shot up across the countries where commercial agriculture and the new corporate seeds were introduced. So the states which had the highest commercial agriculture, Punjab, Andhra Pradesh, Karnataka, are the states where suddenly we saw for the first time in India history the emergence of farmers' suicides. And on our count, last year, we had lost 25,000 farmers. So when Lee took his life in Cancun, it was very, very much a reflection of a pattern. Because farming by itself cannot be a negative economy. It means someone's working with their labor, with the land, with the water, with the biodiversity, producing food. How on earth can you go wrong with that? You can't. The only reason it goes wrong is farming is no more about producing food and giving a just return to the labor of the producer. It is about corporations having the freedom to extract more and more from the farmer in terms of selling inputs, and more from the consumers in terms of selling bad food. And at both ends, those who do not work to produce end up being the ones who gain. Everyone else loses. Farmers lose with their very lives. Consumers also lose with their very lives. And the obesity epidemic should be a wake-up call to us that we are paying for this commodity-driven food culture, industry-driven, agribusiness-driven food culture with our very lives. And it's time for us to say, we will live, we will celebrate our lives, we will grow food of the kind that nourishes the earth and our bodies. And we're not really having to make a sacrifice to do this, because frankly, the alternative available is no alternative at all. The alternative of genetic engineering is a failed promise. After 20 years, there's only two applications, herbicide resistance and Bt toxins, and no reasonable human being would say we need more herbicides in our ecosystems and we need toxins in our crops. Neither of them are very, very brilliant inventions. In any case, the other inventions which are talked about are also not very brilliant, like the golden rice, which you're told that you should allow to come into the market so that third world kids can stop going blind. Well, third world children are going blind because in our farms, our sources of vitamin A were destroyed and killed. Our women are suffering from anemia because of our sources of biodiversity, of iron, were destroyed with herbicides. So now they bring alternatives like a herbicide-resistant vitamin A rice, which you'd have to eat 3 kilograms of to get adequate vitamin A. In any case, there are rices which have more vitamin A than genetic engineering can give you. But most importantly, nature has given us such tremendous varieties of crops. Our greens, our corianders, our fenugreek, the amaranth, the papaya, the mango, the pumpkin. There's no dearth of sources of vitamin A, 70 to 100 times more efficient in meeting our needs. And frankly, much tastier in terms of adding our food. So we have two applications. We have one company. 90% of all GM crops planted anywhere in the world is Monsanto. Three countries account for the 90% of genetically modified crops grown. Now, this is not the impression you get when you read newspapers, because the newspaper releases come from an industry-driven think tank called ISAAA, the International Service for the Acquisition of Agricultural Biotechnology. And the way these figures are presented, you really think it's GM all over. There's no alternative left. And it's designed to make you feel alternatives aren't possible. That's one reason we decided to produce a report. We took the decision at the last biodevastation. And at that last biodevastation meeting, which was in May in St. Louis, and I want to thank Brian for having started this process of biodevastation meetings, because before that, if you said the word Monsanto in this country, you would get sued. Your books wouldn't be published, your films wouldn't be shown, and we literally had to come and offer solidarity to say it's all right to say Monsanto. It's all right. I think our commitment should be, not only should it be all right to say Monsanto, but we should be celebrating in 1 or 2 years to say, here was one criminal corporation we actually succeeded in shutting down. Let me tell you why I think it's necessary that Monsanto should be shut down. Because without it, we will never have freedom. In May last year, Monsanto used its own administration, because let's admit, White House is a Monsanto White House, to bring a case to WTO, which is also a Monsanto-like institution. Monsanto went on record in saying that in shaping the intellectual property rights rules, we were the patient, the physician, and the diagnostician all in one. Basically, in effect, saying WTO is us, White House is us. So Monsanto, as White House, sues through WTO as Monsanto to say the Europeans should be force-fed with GM crops. How dare they make the choices they are making to not want genetically modified food? And of course, the argument constantly used was this is about hunger. And I remember last year, around November, the European Environment Commissioner, Margaret Wallstrom, said, There's only one hunger that's involved, and it's the hunger of the corporations, not the hunger of people. So here's a system being used, a system that is totally corrupted, to basically think they're going to get away with a dispute and a decision from that dispute to do what they've already done with intellectual property, which is use WTO to force India to create monopolies on seed, to create monopolies on medicine, the kind of monopolies that make AIDS medicine, which we are today supplying to the world for $200, but which is available only at $20,000 under the patent regimes in this country. They want that alternative of low-cost seed and low-cost medicine taken away. This is not a rule-based system. It is a system for misrule. This is not a system for justice. It is a system to put brute force into place at every level, in every national government, in every international institution. But the kind of abuse of prisoners that have shocked all of us, there is an abuse that's going on in our university campuses that is equally torturous. What happened to Putsai in England? What happened to Ignacio Chapella? Any scientist who stayed free, who stayed independent, who stayed honest, was hounded out of their work and their situation. We need to liberate our knowledge. We need to liberate our science. We need to liberate our scientists. A corporation that can turn every independent and free mind into a hounded human being is criminal. They are equal to those who were torturing in the prison. In any case, it has now become very, very clear that the reason they need to shut down independent science is because their entire edifice is based on falsehood. Let me very quickly run through one or two data. In India, BT cotton totally failed last year. It's the only crop we've allowed them to grow so far, and only in four states. We've not allowed them to grow any food crop. But they had promised 1,500 kilograms of yield. The yields were only 200 kilograms per average. They had promised farmers would get an additional 10,000 rupees. Farmers lost an average of 6,400 rupees an acre. Well, you could say last year was a drought year. This year would be better. This year's data shows that they've exaggerated. Monsanto's data is exaggerating the farm yields by 16 times, the farmer's income by 100 times, and the reduction in chemicals and pesticides by 4 times. They got two scientists, Kaim and Zilberman, to publish in Science last year how Indian farmers had increased productivity of 50%. Well, neither Kaim nor Zilberman came to India during the commercial planting. They never visited a single farmer's field. This data was provided by Monsanto. There's another miracle that's referred to, the Mathakini Flats in South Africa. Supposed to be a huge, huge miracle. There's a fellow called Buthelezi. I wouldn't be surprised if they haven't brought him here. But Buthelezi is brought as a small farmer. He owns 63 acres. Every time when Zolik threatens the rest of the world, Buthelezi is standing next to him. He's paid to go around and say they have had miracles. But the farmers in Mathakini Flats did not choose the seeds, because there's one company that deals with the cotton farmers. Monsanto had license agreements with this one company. Farmers had absolutely no choice. The debts of farmers have increased in that area of South Africa, just like the debts of Indian farmers. So we are really talking about the death of truth. We are talking about the death of freedom. We are not just talking about one additional bad technology, one additional bad corporation. We are talking about an experiment to extinguish every freedom that being human involves. That is why they had to go after Percy Schmeiser, the Canadian farmer. That is why in Argentina, Monsanto is trying to use the government to extract money out of farmers. And the assessment is $35 million a year. That is why in country after country, corporations are being corrupted. That is why WTO is being used against Europe. And that is why we need to very quickly strengthen the alternatives that already are there, and strengthen them strategically, strengthen them with solidarity. I started to save seeds as an alternative. But in the process, much deeper movements have grown. Since 1999, a movement of freedom villages. We call it Jaif Panchayat, which means living democracy in Hindi. Villages where no chemical, no GM seed, no patent on life enters. These are genuinely free villages. There are more than 4,000 of them across the country right now. And this new report we've done for the whole world about what is the reality of GM crops and what are people saying about this, not Monsanto, not ISAAA, not scientists they hire, across the world, north and south, rich and poor, citizens are voting for GM-free food. And the campaign on GM-free zones, in my view, is one of the fastest growing movements of our times. We cannot leave it to lip service. We have to turn the freedom from genetic engineering and freedom from the corporations that would push it, and freedom from the governments that would help the corporations. We have to turn it into our life choices. That's a choice we can and we must make. There is another area where we just have to start working much stronger. When I started Navdanya, I started with the commitment that I could not think of life and its rich diversity as human invention and therefore as human property. The privatization and ownership of living resources was unacceptable to me. But 93 onwards, when we could see the new GATT coming into shape, we organized huge rallies and started making the commitment that we would not recognize patents on life, because for us they were a moral degradation. We call it the Bij Satyagraha. Bij means seed, that from which life arises. Satyagraha is the fight for truth. And we take our inspiration from Gandhi, who said, there is no superstition and no myth as deep as the one citizens start to believe that unjust laws and brute force are meant to be obeyed. Unjust laws are meant to be not cooperated with. A higher humanity demands that of us.
You've been listening to a lecture by Dr. Vandana Shiva at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Geary Street in San Francisco on June 5th, 2004. This is Carolyn Crane from the Left Coast Radio Network. You can visit us at www.leftcoastradio.org.